From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 40 years ago, this Saturday, CBS viewers were watching the soap opera As the World Turns when Walter Cronkite interrupted.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The nation would learn that President Kennedy died 30 minutes later at Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas. 4 decades on, John F. Kennedy's assassination still fuels speculation about the might-haves, would-haves, and could-have-beens if the young president had lived. One of the enduring questions of Kennedy's scholarship has been what JFK would have done in Vietnam. University of Texas scholar James Galbraith has reviewed previously classified documents and tapes and concluded that just weeks before his death, Kennedy had secretly ordered a U.S. pullout from Vietnam. Other scholars have fiercely disputed this view, but Galbraith writes that reexamining the story of JFK and Vietnam in the fall of 1963 tests our capacity as a country to look at our own history and at its implications, to look them in the eye. As the country now faces another indefinite military commitment in Iraq, what was John F. Kennedy's policy toward Vietnam at the hour of his death? Tonight on Point, exit strategies 40 years ago and now. Are you prepared to believe that if JFK had lived, the Vietnam War might have been averted? Or does that sound to you like just another Camelot myth? Are vast governments capable of reversing course after they commit their prestige to a cause? And what can we learn from JFK and Vietnam, 1963? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Professor James Galbraith of the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His article, Exit Strategy, appears in the current edition of Boston Review. Good evening and welcome, James Galbraith.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Galbraith.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
James Galbraith, take us in here. You're very forthright in saying that scholars left, right, and center have for years absolutely not believed that JFK had the country on a different path than LBJ, his successor, took the country on, that is, staying in Vietnam and escalating the war. We'll come to a bit of that dispute, but you've concluded otherwise. And before we get into the details, I wish you'd just share with us from your review, from your study, and from the work that you're now looking at, what do you now see as having gone on in those last months of John F. Kennedy's life as president? What was he, in your view, planning for Vietnam?
Okay. To begin with, I don't want to exaggerate my role. I am far from being the only person who's concerned with this history to reach this conclusion. It is first stated in a book by Peter Dale Scott in 1972. It's mentioned by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., no mean historian, in his book on Robert Kennedy in 1978. It is extensively documented in John Newman's book in 1992, JFK in Vietnam, and most recently by a historian at the University of Alabama, Howard Jones, who published a book called Death of a Generation with Oxford University Press earlier this year. So I am writing in a tradition which has quite a number of very solid works that have basically reached this conclusion.
And you're very forthright about that at the same time as you acknowledge the contrary view. But you're very forthright about the shoulders that you're standing on here. But when you
pull
that all that together, what do you see?
Well, let me talk a little bit about the other side as well. What you have on the other side is a much larger body of writing, which includes almost all of the famous accounts by journalists on the Vietnam history, most of which are now quite dated and pass over the transition between Kennedy and Johnson in just a few words. And then you have also some accounts by historians which either come close to accepting this thesis or dispute it outright.
So you've got Noam Chomsky, Kai Bird, William Gibbons, Walt Rostow, and so on.
Yes, that's right.
Please, I'm sure we'll hear more of that, but we'd like to get just the baseline story of what you believe actually happened.
Well, in the fall of 1963, in early October, as you said in your introduction, Kennedy received a report, which was not a surprise to him, from his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, mm-hmm. the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Maxwell Taylor, which contained military recommendations that included a basically two-part withdrawal of U.S. forces from Vietnam. 1,000 soldiers in particular units were to be pulled out by the end of 1963, and the rest down to what were described as the pre-insurgency level were to be pulled out by the end of 1965.
A couple of interesting things. If you can give us the context, first of all, what was the troop strength? The American presence was way, way below what we later saw under LBJ. How large was it?
It was around 17,000 soldiers, so mm-hmm. it was not a large number of soldiers. They were combat advisors. They were doing some fighting, but they were combat advisors. They were engaged mainly in training missions.
And the number of deaths, the casualties that the U.S. had taken at that point in Vietnam?
I don't know offhand.
But very small, three digits,
sure.
I think.
Sure.
I mean, far, far less than the 50,000 that was the ultimate number.
No. We had not introduced main combat forces at that point.
Mm-hmm. And the dual withdrawal was important because there was an election coming up in 1964. So you're suggesting that JFK, was this a political idea to bring 1,000 out before the election and the remainder out after the election?
Well, you're not going to hear in the official records of the discussion of this decision a political calculus. A number of people who talked to Kennedy around the subject heard him say that the bulk would come out after the 1964 election. I'm inclined to believe that there was a political calculus, but there was also a military argument for having a phased withdrawal. There was a mission that was going on. Certain things were being done. Soldiers were being trained to fly helicopters, for example, and those missions could be continued for a certain time mm-hmm. and then turned over to the Vietnamese.
What was the rationale that McNamara and Taylor, General Taylor, gave to JFK? What was JFK himself thinking when he came to the conclusion, as you see it, that the U.S. troops should come out?
Well, that's a very difficult question because in the official record, Kennedy does not state his justification for making this decision. And there's a great deal of dispute over that point. There are those, and Noam Chomsky is probably the leading exponent of this point of view, who argue that since the official military reporting up to that moment was relatively optimistic, that this was a withdrawal plan that was contingent on military success before the troops came out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's not a correct interpretation and that basically what we see, and certainly some of the new evidence points rather strongly in this direction, is that Kennedy's decision was unconditional. That's what Howard Jones says in exactly those words. It did not depend upon victory having been achieved. And at any rate, the definition of victory at that moment was rapidly being reduced to something that was not really very meaningful. So what we have here was a decision to bring the soldiers who were in Vietnam home, whether or not the major military operations had been concluded by the end of 1965.
And why the urgent desire to do that? You write of the October 2nd meeting, just 6 weeks before JFK's assassination, where you have McNamara saying, we need a way to get out of Vietnam, and this is a way of doing it. Why was that need so acutely felt?
Well, I think there are a number of things going on in Kennedy's administration at this particular point. First of all, I do believe that he had come to the conclusion that the war was not going to be won and could not be won by external military intervention, so that there was no purpose in getting bogged down there. There were people who wanted to increase the U.S. presence. Those people, of course, their position eventually prevailed. Getting soldiers out before that happened simply reduced the risk of trouble down the road. Secondly, Kennedy in the summer of 1963, and indeed this is developing through his entire administration, is pursuing a broader strategy of reduction of tensions. He is prepared to take a stand and to force the Soviets to back down where it is absolutely essential that he do so.
So you mean a global reduction of tensions?
A global reduction of tensions, absolutely. A global reduction of tensions. I mean, we had a stand in over Berlin. He was not going to yield there. He was not going to let Soviet atomic missiles stay in Cuba, and they did not stay in Cuba, although he was prepared to concede the right of the Cubans to essentially to be free of an invasion. He was not prepared, on the other hand, to put U.S. forces into Laos in 1961. He pressed for and got a partial test ban treaty in 1963. He spoke in 1963 in the summer at American University of essentially a grand strategy of accommodation with the Soviet Union, moving toward a much more peaceful world.
And Vietnam in particular.
Not getting it. Vietnam was in the class of things where it was not important enough if you couldn't win it to prolong the agony indefinitely.
And you're saying that in 1962, Robert McNamara and others were already realizing that Vietnam couldn't be won, as you say, by outside military forces?
Well, you had at this moment a government in Vietnam, which was headed by the president, Diem, who was a figure with very limited popular appeal compared to Ho Chi Minh in North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He had enormous difficulties internally, even amongst the non-communist population of South Vietnam, as a result of the fact that he was Catholic and he was ran a policy which was greatly to the disadvantage of the Buddhists of South Vietnam. That was an issue that was very salient in Washington in the summer of 1963.
Buddhist monks were burning themselves alive in the streets in Vietnam. His wife was calling them barbecued bonzes, not very empathetic.
No, it wasn't Diem's wife. It was the wife of his
brother. Yes.
That's right. And so you have a situation in which there is a loss of confidence in Washington in the ability of the government of Vietnam to prosecute a war effectively. But more than that, you have a situation in which there's very grave doubt that you can overcome the insurgency in the long run, certainly by the application of external military power.
And McNamara talking again in October 63, just weeks before JFK's death, about a, quote, total lack of consensus over the battlefield situation in Vietnam.
Well, there was at that time, if you like, a climate of change in the military intelligence. The official reporting had been substantially optimistic through the spring and summer of 1963. It began to become more realistic and more pessimistic as the fall unfolded. I think it's also fair to say that at the highest levels of the U.S. administration, there were those, and the president was one of them, who were skeptical about the intelligence they were getting. I think that's also true of the vice president, Lyndon Johnson, who had his own channels of information on what was going on in Vietnam. So you had a situation in which the military intelligence was officially optimistic, but the optimism had some pretty serious skeptics amongst the readerships at the highest level.
We'll hear more about that. But, Jack Beattie, I want to get just a bit of you in here. Do you buy the basic premise that JFK would have had America out of this defining kind of debacle of the 20th century?
Well, I'd like to believe it because I was, as a young man, I was a great Kennedy enthusiast. But I think the strongest counter evidence is the coup of November 1st, 1963, against President Diem in Vietnam. That was mounted with U.S. connivance at one level or another. The president and Ambassador Lodge didn't explicitly tell the South Vietnamese not to kill Diem and his brother and wife, and they were killed. And when Kennedy heard that, he got up and walked out of the room. Arthur Schlesinger said, "I'd never seen him so depressed. No doubt he realized Vietnam was his great failure in foreign policy." And I'll explain why. when we come back.
We'll hear more from James Galbraith and our own Jack Beatty in a moment. We're talking tonight about JFK's death 40 years ago and whether that assassination derailed an exit strategy that would have prevented the Vietnam War. Are you prepared to believe that if JFK had lived, the Vietnam War would never have happened, would have been cut short, or is that a kind of Camelot myth? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the death of John F. Kennedy, President John F. Kennedy, and whether that assassination in November 1963 derailed an exit strategy that would have prevented the Vietnam War, a subject of great interest then and great interest again today as we look at the situation unfolding in Iraq. Our guest tonight is Professor James Galbraith. He joins us from Austin, Texas. He's professor of government at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. He's author of Exit Strategy, an article in the October-November issue of Boston Review. You can join the conversation as well tonight. Are governments capable of radically shifting policy after they commit the prestige, their military might? Do you want the kind of president who knows how to shift gears or stay the course? And is the Vietnam story a useful parallel at all to Iraq today or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Vicky's calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Vicky. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling because I recently read McNamara's memoir, which came out in 93, and and it specifically states, I guess maybe you've read it,
In retrospect.
Right. That he thinks that had Kennedy lived, he would have pulled out of Vietnam, using very similar arguments to Galbraith. And I was wondering sort of what, if I could ask your guests how they feel about the memoir and about whether
McNamara's telling. I will do that, Vicky. Let me ask you first. Does it cross your mind that some of the players in this might like that to be the story that's understood because it might paint them in a better picture, in a better light?
Yeah. Well, I think that's actually the sort of the question that I wanted to ask to you, and whether you know this is sort of wishful thinking and in hopes that I'm not saying that he blames it all on Johnson, you know, but
it would make it possible to do that.
Yeah.
We've got it. Vicky, thanks for your call. James Galbraith.
It's a very interesting and important question, and I give McNamara a great deal of credit in my article. His book is a central element in this story. What we're talking about here, let's be clear, is not a question of what Kennedy might have done had he not been killed. It's a question of whether he did or did not give his formal approval to a recommendation for a withdrawal plan. That's a fact. He did give that approval. The recommendation was made to him on the 2nd of October by McNamara, who says, and I'm looking at the transcript right now, we need a way to get out of Vietnam. This is a way of doing it. And he approves the recommendation and the schedule. What we didn't know before was that there was behind that process, this was not just a casual conversation in the White House, there was, as there must be with a presidential national security decision, an elaborate process of planning. Who is going to get out? On what timetable? Who will be? How much will be left at the end? These questions had been worked out over the spring and summer of 1963 under McNamara's direct supervision. So we're looking here in McNamara's memoir at a statement of fact. Now, the other question that we have is, did McNamara have anything personal to gain from stating the facts this way? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that is no, he didn't have anything to gain for a number of reasons. First of all, and the caller has the book, so she can see this very clearly, mm-hmm. McNamara never once tries to escape responsibility for the larger question of how the war in Vietnam was conducted later when it really got underway in earnest with large numbers of American soldiers, heavy casualties, and he was the guy in charge. He is extraordinarily forthright about his responsibility, and I've seen him in discussions with other senior members of that administration. He will not permit anybody else to be assigned responsibility that he believes should rest properly on his own shoulders. So that's number one. Number two is McNamara served both Kennedy and Johnson, and he did so with exemplary loyalty. He doesn't have anything to gain He's not a Kennedy man, in other words, although he started with Kennedy. He doesn't have anything to gain by elevating Kennedy and tearing down Johnson. And I think the story as it affects Lyndon Johnson is another complicated story. And I'm not presenting a story here that is, as you described it, Camelot myth-making. I think Lyndon Johnson's role in the story is also very interesting and needs to be understood as it was.
Absolutely fascinating. And we'll come to that.
But my point is that McNamara simply has nothing to gain by trying to revise history in a false way.
But wouldn't he at least be able to say
it? He wouldn't be able to get away with it because the documentary record would not back him up. But the fact is that McNamara said very clearly in his book what happened. You can read this on pages 78 to 80 of McNamara's memoir, which was published in 1995. In 1997 or 98 only, do we get the supporting documents from the archives? Do we get the tapes from the Kennedy Library? And those essentially support what McNamara says. They give complete corroboration to McNamara's account. So if he were lying, they wouldn't. And I think the only reasonable inference that one can draw about McNamara's book is that he is telling the truth on factual matters and at the same time assuming responsibility, because that is the only way to maintain even the smallest amount of credibility with the public. If he at once, at any point, said, well, the truth is that I recommended that we withdraw and tried to use that to defend his own reputation, of course, he would have been dismissed out of hand.
And yet, as you say, James Galbraith, the what it comes down to here is a kind of an interpretation of whether JFK would have been willing to stay the course toward withdrawal, whatever the situation in Vietnam.
Well, that's a separate question. No. That is not the historical question that I've been addressing. The historical question that I've been addressing is, was there a withdrawal plan? Yes, there was. Was it approved? Yes, there was. Yes, it was. Was it in some sense airbrushed from history so that it became very difficult to get the details of this over the subsequent 30 years? That is also true. Now, the question you raise, would he have stayed the course in the face of the coup in Saigon on November 1st and its aftermath, in the face of a deteriorating military situation through 64 and 65, that becomes the speculative question. And it's very clear to distinguish between what is – very important to distinguish between what is speculative and what is not. That is an important speculative question. I do not know the answer to that any more than you do, except to say that it seems to me that in October of 1963, when he's essentially last heard from on the subject, Kennedy's determination was to withdraw from Vietnam whether or not victory could be achieved, and in the face of considerable skepticism that it could be achieved.
We'll turn to that. Jack Beattie, I want to come to you first, though. You're looking at this through the lens of the coup that came in November 1963. You're saying this is where the doubts get raised in your mind. Play that out for us, Jack.
Right. Well, what were the motives for this coup? Well, it's clear now that President Diem's brother, an official in the government, his vice president, I believe, was negotiating or trying to negotiate with the NLF, that is to say the Viet Cong, to let them into some sort of coalition government. That's at least what some historians think. And that they essentially would then turn on the Americans and say, look, we've made our deal. You guys go home. Now, think of that. The CIA must have known that these negotiations were afoot. They were having other problems with Diem, but they knew this was happening. They knew, in other words, that the Vietnam War might have ended before it began because our satrap, the South Vietnamese government, was ready to do a deal with its domestic opposition. And the coup happened with U.S. connivance. So, yes, Kennedy had these intentions, but the objective deed was essentially to cut off the chance that the war could have ended before it began.
And why are these mutually exclusive, Jack?
Well, I'm saying that the one is an intention, the other is a deed. And once that deed was done, the U.S. was then effectively responsible for the South Vietnamese government, general after general. They became our baby. The war became ours. And
the chance that the that a war, you know, everything really sort of happened after that coup. Now there are all sorts of historical questions there, but we are dealing with what ifs. And the counter what if is, what if this coup had not been allowed to happen? What if in fact the Vietnamese had made their own deal and we had been able to leave? In that case, Kennedy, far from preventing the Vietnam War, you could say that he helped cause it, bring it on.
Because he shut down that path, as you're looking at it there, Jack. James Galbraith.
It is, I think, correct that New, Diem's brother, had conversations with representatives of the, with intermediaries for the North Vietnamese, specifically, I believe, with the Polish representative on the Control Commission.
And talking about kicking the Americans out of Vietnam.
No, just talking about it. Well, I don't know how. The fact is that they had a conversation, right? I do not know of any evidence that that possibility figured in the discussions which led to the coup cable of August 24th, 1963, which was basically engineered by Averell Harriman, Roger Hilsman, Michael Forrestal, in the White House, in the absence of some of the other major players.
The coup cable, that is a green light from Washington?
A green light to lodge for a coup that did not occur, that might have occurred in September. Hmm. This has showed, actually, the Kennedy White House at its worst, and that's something I say in my article, in a state of disorganization with essentially a seizure of control over this aspect of policy by a group that did not have the entire government behind them. And the results were grim. But there is no reason to believe that Averell Harriman, who had his own very separate reasons for being opposed to Diem, would have objected to a conversation between Nu and the an intermediary for Ho Chi Minh over some kind of neutralization of the situation.
So you're saying
Harriman, after all, was the man Kennedy sent to Laos in 1961 to achieve exactly that outcome. He was the man that Johnson sent to Paris in 1968 who achieved that outcome on the middle of October 1968.
So the JFK government would have accepted some kind of deal between North and South, whether or not it left the South free in American terms.
This was not, I believe, the reason why the Kennedy administration or parts of it were disaffected with Diem. Quite the contrary. I think they felt, you can go through the history here and you can listen to the meetings. There are discussions on tape of the South Vietnamese government situation, and it's about, first of all, their military ineffectiveness and about their mistreatment of the Buddhists at that point. So you have a widespread impression that Diem is simply not going to become a sustainable and effective leader of that country. You don't hear, at least I have not heard, and I would certainly be very interested in seeing evidence that there is a discussion, for example, of the potential of a sellout to the North Vietnamese. That's not something I believe that there's evidence for.
We're talking tonight about JFK's death and whether that death, that assassination, derailed an exit strategy that would have prevented the Vietnam War. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. George is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Getting back to Secretary McNamara.
Yes.
And putting aside the 1990s when he was trying to reconcile himself to history and get back to the period itself, how does Professor Galbraith account for the fact that McNamara, who took his role as Secretary of Defense professionally very seriously, remained in office as Secretary and was the chief architect of the great escalation that occurred starting in 64 and 65 and beyond. I mean, it's hard to reconcile that record with what you're saying about his advisory to Kennedy back, way back in the fall of 1963.
It is indeed. It's a great and big question. George, let us pick it up. James Galbraith.
It is a very big question. And one has to say that it's a very difficult question. I can't offer you a definitive answer to it. The direction I would go, though, is to say perhaps Robert McNamara had even larger issues on his mind, and that perhaps at this time Kennedy and also Johnson had larger issues on their minds. This was an extraordinarily dangerous period in world history. It was a period in which there was an extraordinarily unstable strategic balance, one that favored, actually, the United States. Preserving the peace under those conditions, the nuclear peace, was a preoccupation to an extent that I don't think we can imagine for the highest level civilians in the government at that time. If you want a sense of this, I mean, the best place to get it is in the accounts of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But the Cuban Missile Crisis is 14 days, 12 days. Mm-hmm. I think the fact of the situation is the underlying unstable situation went on for much, much longer than that. And maintaining a position in which the U.S. pursued its policy goals but did not get close to the nuclear button was just an extraordinarily heavy response and important responsibility.
And so you're saying in response to George's question that Robert McNamara felt he had to escalate the war in Vietnam to avoid confrontation?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that he had an enduring responsibility to maintain the nuclear peace against which, in the scale of things, nothing else comes close.
But it's a heck of a step from withdrawal to 500,000 troops.
Yes, of course it is. But I'm not talking to you about what happened in Vietnam between 1963 and, mm-hmm. and 1966 right now. There's a very interesting passage. I mean, again, if you want just a glimpse into this world, I strongly recommend Daniel Ellsberg's new book, Secrets, an extraordinary personal account of his experience in Vietnam, of the Pentagon Papers, but with vignettes of what he was told when he worked, not quite directly for McNamara, but for his deputy, John McNaughton, about the U.S. position on nuclear weapons. It was our position at the time that if the Soviets crossed any line in Europe, they would be met, that was the NATO position, with an atomic response. It was, however, and you can find this, and your first caller can find it in the around page 342, I believe, of McNamara's memoir, that he had recommended to both Kennedy and Johnson that under no circumstances should the U.S. Make the first use of an atomic weapon.
James Galbraith, stand by. We've got to take a break. We'll come back and close the circle. We're talking about JFK's death and whether that derailed an exit strategy that would have prevented the Vietnam War. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and whether that death derailed an exit strategy that would have prevented the Vietnam War. You can join the conversation tonight. Did the assassination of JFK prolong the war in Vietnam? Is the Vietnam story a useful parallel to Iraq or not? And do live American presidents have the option of pulling out of conflicts whether the U.S. is winning or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is James Galbraith, professor of government, Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, and author of the new article, Exit Strategy, in the Boston Review. Jack Beatty, you're listening patiently along here tonight, and it's a complicated story with many twists and turns. We have to hear more about this nuclear piece because James Galbraith does close that circle to describe the pressures brought to bear on Lyndon Johnson and maybe through him on Robert McNamara.
But what comes through these days overall to me is this picture of a president watching a distant conflict, getting conflicting intelligence, having the CIA kind of turn around a number of times on its overall interpretation of what was going on, and finally coming to a conclusion to get out sooner rather than later, even in a situation where the stakes were seen as very high. If today they're seen as high around terror, they were obviously seen as very high then about the threat of communism.
It's true. I mean, but on the other hand, here's what he said to CBS News. I don't agree with those who say we should withdraw. That would be a great mistake. This is a very important struggle, even though it's far away. We made this effort to defend Europe. Now Europe is secure. We also have to participate, we may not like it, in the defense of Asia. And in the speech that he didn't deliver in Dallas because he was shot, he said, we dare not weary of the task. So his rhetoric, although he said to people like Wayne Morse, you guys are right about Vietnam and we'll get out, but we have to do it after the 64 elections. He was also saying this. And by the way, that statement to Wayne Morse, think about it. My brother-in-law was in Vietnam at the time. And when I put that to him, he said, well, so Kennedy was going to let me and the rest of us stay out there on the limb in what he knew was a losing cause.
For another year and more.
For another year and more so that he could be reelected. That doesn't reflect very well on him at all. I think it's kind of damning, actually. On the other side, though,
but
Daniel Ellsberg has a very, and this is in Jamie's direction, has a very fascinating revelation. He talked to Robert Kennedy in the fall of 1967, and Robert Kennedy said, my brother was going to get out. He was going to make it a Laos kind of deal. And he said, and then Ellsberg said, well, no one wanted to get out at the time. What made him so smart? And Robert Kennedy took his hand and slammed it on the desk. And he said, we were there in 1951. We saw what was happening to the French. We saw it. My brother was determined never to let that happen to us. He was referring to the one day John Kennedy spent in Vietnam in 1951. In the morning, he spoke to the French general in charge, who had quarter of a million French troops there. He said, oh, we're going to beat these peasants. In the evening, he talked to an American consular official who said that in 20 years, there'll be no more colonies. The French are going to lose here. And if we come in, we'll lose. And for the same reason, our people won't support it. And according to Robert Kennedy, that insight never left him.
James Galvin, how about this public and private face?
That is a remarkable story, and I'm glad you raised it because you have it in front of you, and I was going to mention it as well. The other point, which I apologize for interjecting, is that what you say about leaving the troops in harm's way, partly for electoral purposes, certainly does not reflect well on Kennedy. And that fact, it seems to me, also stands as a rebuttal to those who say that this excavation is Camelot mythmaking. I don't think it is. I think what we're getting here is a small piece of a very large jigsaw puzzle, and we're trying to figure out how to put it in precisely the right way, because in part that will help us understand the rest of the history of this period.
James Galbraith, let me ask you, one piece of that jigsaw puzzle was your father, John Kenneth Galbraith.
Yes.
How did he figure in here? What was the advice that he was giving President Kennedy?
He was involved from the very beginning in 1961. He was sent by Kennedy in September to Saigon to essentially give a second opinion on a rather belligerent report that had been just submitted to Kennedy. And Dad likes to say that he was sent because Kennedy knew that he did not have an open mind. He turned in at first an oral and then I think later a written report, a number of letters, warning that the Vietnamese adventure was not viable.
And our time is so short, but I have to ask you, because the question still sits there, why, if this was the plan under Kennedy, why did LBJ change course? And you bring it back to the nuclear threat. And as I understand you, you're saying LBJ felt some pressure to either escalate the war conventionally, or there was a party in the U.S. military that wanted to go nuclear?
Well, one of the things that's going on in Vietnam that we also know was going on in Iraq is a part of the government operating on an agenda which was not necessarily that of the president. This may have been what happened to Johnson in the first days after Kennedy was killed, when he was presented with NSAM 273, which authorized covert raids against North Vietnam. Very small things, but an escalation that led to the Tonkin Gulf incident. Mm. My sense of Johnson is that he knew as well as Kennedy did what a miserable military situation this was, and that he was also looking for a way to avoid it, and continued to do so for a very long time. I think when the dust settles on that history, we will learn that Johnson did not decide on the final commitment of major U.S. combat forces until quite late in the game.
Jim
this
Scott,
did not
you,
happen right over the assassination.
I hate to say it, but we're out of time. We thank you so much for joining us tonight, for your research and for your piece. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
James Galbraith, author of Exit Strategy in Boston Review's October-November issue. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, the voice of JFK on stage long after November 1963. This is On Point. Forty years ago Saturday, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. It was a day that no American then alive will ever forget. Comedian Von Meter has not forgotten. Meter built a career around his impeccable impersonation of JFK. He spawned a brand of comedy, the presidential impersonation, that would later be picked up by the likes of Dana Carvey and Rich Little. On Point archaeologist Ned Connors digs up the sounds and stories of years past for our program. Tonight he brings us the story of JFK impersonator Von Meter.
The following is a public service announcement. Election day is near. Go to the polls and vote. Vote for the Kennedy of your choice, but vote.
On the evening of October 22, 1962... in front of a live Manhattan audience primed with free drinks and hors d'oeuvres, a cast of comedians led by 26-year-old newcomer Von Meter taped 17 short skits poking fun at the Kennedy White House.
Next question.
Yes, I should like to ask a question about...
Would you identify yourself, please?
I'm your wife. I should like to ask the following question.
No, speak English, Jackie.
On the same night, President John F. Kennedy announced to a worried nation that the Soviet Union had installed missiles in Cuba and that the U.S. was about to erect a naval blockade of the island. The Cuban Missile Crisis had begun.
I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and the stable relations between our two nations.
This confluence of political comedy and real-life Cold War terror could have been disastrous to Meter's career, but the opposite happened. Khrushchev blinked, and Kennedy emerged wildly popular from the Cuban Missile standoff. Meter's live recording of skits based on his deadly accurate impersonation of the president hit the shelves in November, just in time for holiday sales, selling 4 million copies in its first month of distribution, an industry sales record that held for 20 years.
Jesse?
Fill her up, please.
This car?
No, all 70 of them and the... and the motorcycles.
Yes, sir.
By the way, do you give green stamps?
No, sir, we don't.
Forget it.
Von Meter, a native of Maine, got his start in comedy doing political stand-up. This type of comedy was pretty well established by 1960 in the work of Lenny Bruce and Mort Sahl. One of Meter's club routines was to take unrehearsed questions from the audience and answer them in the persona of a contemporary political stereotype. During one club date, he prefaced a response with a flawless Kennedyism.
Well, let me say this about that.
The audience cracked up. Meter, who knew a good thing, elaborated on the Kennedy routine the following night, and it took off from there. The club manager happened to know producer Earl Dowd, who, it turns out, had been looking for some way to parody the Kennedy White House on record. Dowd and co-producer Bob Booker hired a cast of seasoned voice characters from radio and TV, and even played a few characters themselves. The album was called The First Family, released on Cadence Records, a New York company willing to gamble on a little iconoclasm. I think the best skit on the album is Economy Lunch, in which all the hot spots of early 60s global conflict are played out over a Kennedy economizing measure. he decides to forego an expensive state dinner for world leaders in favor of a working lunch, sending White House Press Secretary Pierre Salinger out for a takeout deli order.
Do you really think you can get away with this?
Well, Pierre, I've been criticized in the newspapers for the big parties and the state dinners. Now we've got to cut down and economy starch at home.
All right.
Around the table are Fidel Castro, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, Nationalist China's Chiang Kai-shek, Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, and Egyptian President Gamal Nasser.
Now, I thought that instead of the formal food we usually serve here, that we would have a typical American businessman's lunch. So I'm going to send down to the delicatessen store for some sandwiches. Well, how does that strike you, gentlemen? Mr. Khrushchev, would you... I appreciate your enthusiasm, but would you mind just taking your shoe off the table? Mr. Chiang Kai-shek.
Club sandwich would be fine. Thank you so much.
Would you like it with a little mayo?
Please, not to mention that name.
I'm sorry. Mr. Nasser.
I'll have a hot pastrami sandwich. I can never get it at home.
What kind of bread?
White toast with lettuce and mayonnaise.
Mr. Nasser.
What do you want, Ben-Gurion?
Look, I know we don't get along. You never listen to me. Now you're fooling around with rockets. But this time, please listen. Pastrami don't go with white bread and lettuce and mayonnaise. Have it on rye bread with mustard and a glass of tea. You'll enjoy.
I think that Mr. Ben-Gurion has a point there.
All right, I'll take a chance.
Good boy.
Mr. Khrushchev.
Oh, you don't have to order special for me. I'll have a bite of everybody else's.
Meter spawned a new genre of comedy record, the presidential spoof. These records turned up through the LBJ and Nixon era, animated not by the affection so apparent on the First Family album, but by the odd personalities of these two presidents and the deepening divisions of Vietnam. There was even an Other Family album, lampooning the Kremlin's First Family. Here, Premier Nikita Khrushchev picks up the hotline to the White House to find out how he can get a recording of his voice into every Soviet parlor.
Hello, hello? Now, little girl, let me speak to Papa. Never mind who this is, little girl. I want to talk with your Papa. I don't care if he's on his rocker or off his rocker.
Meter was in great demand, bringing his Kennedy impersonation to primetime television and the lecture circuit. In the spring of 1963, a follow-up volume was released, and it sold pretty well, too. Following November, Meter had just arrived in Milwaukee for a Wisconsin Democratic Party fundraiser. As he settled into an airport taxi, the driver asked him if he had heard about the president getting shot in Dallas. Meter, thinking that the driver recognized him, guessed that it was an opening line for a joke. The radio was on in the cab, and Meter heard what all of America heard that day. Meter's career ended on the spot. Lenny Bruce remarked at the time that they put two graves in Arlington, one for John Kennedy and one for Vaughn Meter. But Meter's life went on, with some difficulty, for the next several years, including a 1967 trip, in a manner of speaking, to San Francisco during the Summer of Love. He ended up back in his home state of Maine. Now in his late 60s, Meter lives a quiet life near Augusta. He vowed in 1963 never to do the Kennedy routine again. And despite occasional requests to reprise his comedic look at Camelot, he's declined, preferring to find his voice in music.
I spent time in Chicago, Cleveland, and LA.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Till I had my fill. Now I want to drink from a clean Maine lake where fish are swimming still. So I'm going down to Maine.